America for the last 35 years or so, Jeanette Kahn and Paul Levin. Before we get started with Paul interviewing Jeanette, we have a special honor for Jeanette, who we've never been able to get to come to the convention. I don't even know if we've ever invited you before. But we're very, very happy to have you here, and it's the DC 75th anniversary here. And we'd like to acknowledge the great contribution you've made to comics with the Comic Con Ink Club.
Now that we've softened you up completely, we'll get the truth out of you. Okay, so we're going to do this in three pieces. We're going to do first a little section with a little bit of Jeanette's history and a couple of open-ended questions that I will ask her, and she'll be free to answer them in as much or as little detail as she chooses. Then we're going to go to a lightning round, where I'm going to ask her, just tell her names of people or moments in time, and we'll see what her first reaction is. As close to an uncensored Jeanette Kahn as you're likely to get.
Yeah, that is scary.
I have promised not to ask certain questions, but we also have ringers in the audience for the last section of this who are not bound by that promise, and we'll see what people from the audience happen to ask. And you can hear as much of comics history as you would like. Mamzelle. So, just to set the tone with a little bit of short history, Jeanette grew up occasionally reading a comic book from her older brother, particularly Batman comics. She was more a Batman fan than a Superman fan along that process. But comics weren't on her radar as something to do. In her time in college up at Radcliffe, she began the creation of a magazine called Kids, which was a precedent-setting magazine written by kids, for kids, and which in her unique fashion she managed to extract an extraordinary group of people to put together. From our business, Jim Salakrup, who now runs Paper Cuts, age 14, I guess, something like that, was one of Jeanette's contributors. Meg Wolitzer, who went on to be a New York Times best-selling novelist. I think she's on her fourth or fifth novel out there now.
Tom Gamble of The Simpsons.
Okay. So found all these strange kids and had them do this great work. Went on from that, when she got out of school, to a number of very strange projects and occupations, some of which we will touch on later. But in the course of it, immediately went on to create a commercial kids magazine called Dynamite for
thank you, Dynamite fan.
For Scholastic, which became, I guess, the most successful kids magazine economically of its generation. And then, as she put it, went on from there to say, well, I'm not happy with how my business deal is with Dynamite, so let me go smash Dynamite. And she came up with Smash Magazine for one of their competitors. And in all of this process, she attracted the notice of the folks who were running Warner Publishing and Warner Communications, which owned DC Comics in those years. And they thought of DC as being kids publishing. And there wasn't really much of anybody who knew anything about the business of comics, if there was anything to know about it. In those days, comics were kind of in a spiral. And they said, maybe that young girl, you know, she seems to know something about kids' magazines. She'll work cheap. She's got good creative ideas. Let's give her a shot. And suddenly, very strangely to all of us who were sitting there in this comic book company that had never had a woman in a position of significant authority, and had never had an outsider drop into it in a significant position of any sort, and suddenly they announce that there's this 28-year-old woman who's coming in as our new publisher. That was a pretty strange day, Ms. Kahn. Groundhog's Day 1976.
I always say that I saw my shadow and stayed forever.
What did you find when you got there?
Well, I found a company that was mostly male, as Paul said, really. I think maybe there were two women on staff, a secretary and somebody in production. Wasn't ethnically diverse in any way whatsoever. Had a lot of old-fashioned ideas. And I thought, rather incoherent comics. Because I was actually, as Paul said, I did read comics growing up. And it wasn't just, you know, taking my brother's comics when he wasn't looking, but really my brother and I had compiled something of a comic book collection, not the kind you put in plastic covers, but just where you kind of swapped comics with neighborhood kids and kept building up your own collection. And it's true, Batman was indeed my favorite. But I never realized there were people behind comics, but I still had a real affection for comics, and even at school had a subscription. And I know little known facts. And so I thought I had a feeling of comics, especially from when I was younger, and they might have been simpler comics, but they were intelligible comics. And the comics that I was reading, because I was sent a large box of all the DC comics before I arrived, I thought, you don't really make all that much sense. So
1975 wasn't one of the better years in comic book creation. I think if we're dealing with vintages that you want to put aside.
Closer? Is that better? Okay.
In our prime years, I was occasionally motivated to the joke when it was the two of us and Dick Giordano as sort of the core of the management team at one point, that between Dick's hearing, my vision, and Jeanette's soft voice, we were pretty close to the three monkeys.
And in some other ways as well.
Shakespeare works any minute. We promise we'll have them done. So what else did you find in the world of comics when you came there? How did you react to this and to the people and the place? And
well, it was an exhilarating time, because even though I felt that the comics we were publishing left a lot to be desired, at that time the French comics were just sort of coming over to America. I mean, there were different artists and writers who had a hold of Metal Roman, which since none of us really wrote or spoke or read French seemed really dazzling. And it's only when they were finally translated we thought, they don't make so much sense either. But they looked beautiful. And they were printed on glossy paper, and they had beautiful color separations, and they looked tremendously sophisticated. And they were meant for an adult audience. And it showed us what comics could be here in America. And we felt, and I say we because there are a lot of the we here in the audience. I'm so happy to say so many people Paul and I have worked with over the years who really, shoulder to shoulder, we sort of made the long march through China with Mao together and changed the industry together. And it was that was truly a joy. But we saw what comics could be in terms of the aesthetics. And we also saw many other opportunities because when I came to D.C., artists and writers had absolutely no rights whatsoever in their creations. And going back to these really terrible feudal times, but there were no contracts, but there was something stamped on the back of your check when you went to cash it. And when you went to endorse your check, you had to sign right there where that stamp was, which gave all rights throughout the cosmos in perpetuity to DC, to your creation. And as Paul mentioned, you know, I had created magazines, and I fought very hard for rights in my own magazines, and so I came sort of with a zealot's righteousness and said, that is just so wrong that creators don't have any part in this. And of course everybody really working on staff at DC felt the same way. It's just how the industry had been for so many years, and we were part of what is now Time Warner, what was then Warner Communications. And although there was a lot of disgruntlement among artists and writers, there was no union, there was no force pushing at the corporation to say we have to make some changes. But we were dedicated to making those changes, and over time we were able to get the guaranteed return of artwork, a share in royalties, a share in all the ancillary income of any character you created. And in that way we changed the industry, I think, on a moral ground, in a way that was tremendously important to us. And then it had huge creative benefits to boot, because so many extraordinary projects came our way after it became clear that these were not temporary rights that were going to be revoked. These were the rights of of artists and writers of talent. And it led us into really kind of an Elizabethan age of comic books.
I think Jeanette's not doing herself proper service there. It's true that there were certainly people on staff who believed, as you mentioned along the way, or who were angry about these issues. But it certainly wasn't everyone at DC. There were established business people who thought not just this is the way it always had been, but that this was an equitable way for it to happen. And because this had been an industry that had not had unions, there had been a couple of efforts to form guilds or other gatherings, but they had been remarkably unsuccessful, there really wasn't anything resembling competent leadership to bring about the change. And a big piece that you deserve the not only the respect of the group, but the thankfulness, really, of the creative people who followed in the process is because you came in without hostages to the situation. As a fresh voice, you were really able to make the case, and it was in many ways more important to you than anything in your own advantage to change the situation, because you so fervently believed that if you reward creative people for their work, you can get better creative work, which was something resembling a Martian declaration for the comic book industry in 1976. And but as they say in the Ginsu knife commercials, that is not all. So that's not all that you changed. It probably is the most important moral touchstone of your accomplishments, though. I sat on a panel like this at San Diego 2 or 3 years ago when they were celebrating the 20th anniversary of Gays in Comics panel, and they were saying kind words about DC, and I had to explain that really the sensitivity of the company to the diversity of people who work there really dated from the moment when you arrived, and the importance you placed early on in it, often to your own frustration, because you were on our butts to try and make the comics have a more diverse cast in them from the day you got there, and were ignored by 99% of us 99% of the time for the first few years as the evolution took place slowly. But you changed an awful lot that wasn't about the great high moral principles. It was more about the ordinary working process. What do you look back on that you feel like you changed, that you enjoyed changing?
Well, as I said, it was a time of tremendous opportunity, and I think the things that weren't working really created those opportunities. So when I said that, I thought that the comics weren't working at that time, 1976, and for some years to follow, it seemed that we were imposing plots on the characters. And it seemed that to make our comics modern and relevant and immediate to our readers, the characters had to drive the plot. And that became a huge reversal in our comics that, again, took place over years. Everything took place over years. There are no quick fixes. That's why we stayed so long. But that really made a big difference. And also I had a feeling, too, that the comic books really were an amazing medium that could hold any kind of story. And we weren't confined to being a superhero company, that we could, even in our earliest years, publish something like Why I Hate Saturn. And that as long as there were great stories to tell and great characters to drive them, that we could tell them in our medium. And so that became a huge change as we did things like Vertigo and Piranha and Milestone, kept really widening our span of storytelling. And then, of course, there were the kinds of stories we told, because, as Paul said, really when I came to D.C., and I should also say when I came to D.C., the reason we're sitting here today, Paul was a 19-year-old part-time assistant editor, but he was the only person who would say no to me. And I said, he'll go very far.
And I then made an entire career out of saying no to people.
But, we took this the medium that was considered disposable, and we said, we can tell adult stories, and we can tell stories like those Metallo Longs. We can tell them on beautiful paper with beautiful color, hand-painted color, and for those of you who have followed the history of D.C., of course, Ronan was the very first sort of harbinger of that whole movement to come. And of course, the kinds of stories, I mean, everything from Vita Vendetta to Watchmen to Dark Knight, Preacher, Sandman, Fables. that's why I said it was such a heady time, because the ground was shifting under our feet, and wonderful, wonderful things erupted from that.
Speaking of things erupting from under the ground, one of the reasons that seemed to me that you stayed was that you had the opportunity to do an extraordinarily diverse and bizarre range of projects. You literally never knew who you would find in Jeanette's office. It could be Tom Wolfe or Peter Norton or Jared Lanier, who was inventing virtual reality at the time, or almost anybody from any part of the world. That office was kind of a salon of strange things, including things that blew up. And one of, I think, the most memorable moments I think of in terms of your willingness to fight beyond reason for things that you believed in was the vision of you bumping along in an armored personnel carrier in Angola through a landmine field so that you could properly investigate the landmine problem so that we could do anti-landmine comics? True story.
That is true, actually. I felt the comics were such a persuasive medium. As all of you sitting here are testimony to, I mean, comics have not only enriched our lives, but they've given us a point of view about the world, and they've tugged at our hearts. And the Landmine comics came about because I got a call from Judy Collins, the singer, and she's been for many, many years a special emissary for UNICEF, and she has actually cut her records on a Warner Brothers label. And so she called and said...
And she sang at your wedding, as I recall.
Oh, well, there's that, too.
That's not...
And so so Judy had talked to, I guess, the head of... Was it Atlantic? I can't quite remember. One of our labels, about doing something about landmines, because that was such a critical issue, especially because children and animals were among the highest percentage of the casualties. And that person had said, well, you should really go talk to Jeanette Kahn. I think whenever there was a sort of a fifth column issue in the company, they said, oh, you should go talk to Jeanette Kahn, our sort of our resident lefty. So I said to Judy, Judy had an idea about doing a CD and a book and some wonderful ideas, but things that are labor-intensive, very expensive, time-consuming. And I said, I'm not saying this because I'm running a comic book company, but just because comics are inexpensive, they're loved by kids, they have a huge pass-along rate, and we could get them on the ground in places like Bosnia very quickly, and they could make a fundamental difference. And so she said, come meet Madeleine Albright, who was then our ambassador to the UN, and she loved the idea, and soon we were having speaking of the office and the odd people who came, the Department of Defense was in the office, the State Department
Deputy
was in the
Director,
office.
Low Intensity Warfare. Best business card I ever saw.
Humanitarian demining. What was the mining in the first place? I was invited to go on a sort of Department of Defense, State Department trip to investigate landmines, and I thought I should do that. And so, yes, I went throughout a number of countries in Africa.
Well, and the ultimate result, when we went to the White House after the books came out, I remember for that reception, the mayor of one of the towns in Bosnia talking to us and telling us that he'd literally witnessed the comics saving kids' lives. And that's, it's an incredible joy as a creative person to have touched someone's life, but I've never had an experience of equal to that, of having that kind of direct effect. And there is no way in hell those books would have gotten done if those project was being run by anybody more normal as a business person, myself included, because you were just Don Quixote and you were charging that windmill, and it didn't matter how long it took or what was involved or how you would use our... Terry was just patting Lillian on the shoulder for her figuring out how to avoid our being a $5,000 wrench for the government and figuring out the procurement. But it was all really because of your dogged madness.
Madness, that is true. But when Paul says it was gratifying, it was so gratifying, not just in the Landmine comics, but many things that we did. And Mike Carlin's here, and he had the first gay character, I think, in our comic books, in Maggie. And we, Denny O'Neill's not here, but we did a gun control.
Seduction of the Gun?
Seduction of the Gun, a really powerful book about the importance of gun control. And
which Governor Wilder of Virginia argued helped him push through the legislature better gun control laws down there.
Because in the book there was sort of a guns for drugs transaction in Virginia, and that wasn't just arbitrary. It was very easy to get guns in Virginia. So he really we were all invited down to Virginia when the bill was signed. So in many ways, in many subjects over many, many issues of comics, we've tried not just to tell great stories, but we've also tried to make a difference.
Now let's segue out of comics for a second.
Okie dokie.
As you were segueing out of comics, you wrote the one and only book that the world has gotten out of you so far, In Your Space, still available on Amazon.com.
My publicist.
It's a small fee as an agent. An absolutely gorgeous volume. Can you do a two-sentence description of it?
The title In My Space is because it's actually about my where I've lived in the creative spaces in which I live, but also because I love basketball, so it was kind of like in your face, in your space. So it tips its hat to my passions, art and basketball. And it's a book that I hadn't intended to write. The publisher, Bob Abrams, Harry Abrams' son, kept after me all the time, saying, write a book. I said, give me a deadline. And so eventually the book came out, and it's really about the creative process. It's a very autobiographical story about all the decisions and indecisions and countless revisions that are part of the creative process.
And you went on, when life at DC ended finally after 27 years finally, of joyful collaboration, you went off and said, what's more difficult to do creative work in than comics that you can be proud of? I know, film. Excellent. Producers there always get their way. And you went out and charged against that brick wall for a while. But
I specialize in brick walls.
There's a long line of them, like the Great Wall of China, that have dents in them from you hitting your head against them, and a couple that were knocked down entirely. And certainly the best one that you knocked down was Gran Torino.
Well, yes.
Now, how did that start in a sentence or two?
Well, first I should just say, you know, as I mentioned, I've worked with so many people in this room, and it just gives me joy to see all of you. And I've had several wonderful partnerships, one of which is beside me here, and the other, which is but the third person was my earlier years. But of my later years, it's Paul and my wonderful partner, Adam Richman, who's in the audience. He's my producing partner. And And Adam and I were, we had been in business for a little bit of a while and made our first movie. And I got a call, it really was over the transom, from someone who said that he was a very good friend of Craig Mitchell's. And Craig Mitchell had written our first movie. And he said, you know, Craig said he thought you just might read my script. I said, of course I'll read your script. So I'm reading the script, and it's actually kind of slow and a little boring, but I felt very obligated to finish it. And when I did, I said, Adam, this is a really good script. It just needs a lot of work. And Adam read it, and we decided we would option it if Nick Shank, the writer, would do the work. And Nick was great, and he just, you know, delivered a terrific, terrific draft. We always wanted it to be Clint Eastwood. And, Nick had not written the script with Clint in mind. He had just written the character, but we just saw it as Clint. So I thought, how are we going to get it to Clint Eastwood? And I called up Bob Daly, who was head of Warner Brothers for 20 years, and of course our tenures overlapped for 20 of those years. And I said, Bob, could you help me? And Bob said, all right, here's Clint's agent's name and number. You call and say, I just think the world of you. So I make the call. Clint's agent says, so what's the script about? I get out no more than three sentences when he goes, whatever makes you think Clint would be interested in your movie. I mean, he's made Million Dollar Baby, Mystic River, he's shooting Flags of Our Fathers. I don't think so, Click. I don't think so, Click. I don't think so, Click. How could that possibly be?
You'll notice she gives up very easily.
So we wandered in the wilderness for a couple of years after that. We actually attached a director who was a respected director who had worked with older actors. He called Paul Newman because he'd worked with Paul Newman. Paul Newman said, I'm just not sure I have another movie in me. And sadly, he didn't. A friend of mine called Gene Hackman on our behalf, and Gene said, I just want to sail my yacht. And they offered me a gazillion dollars, but otherwise, I just want to sail my yacht. And this again, same director we put on called Sean Connery, with whom we'd worked, and Sean said the same thing, more or less, as Gene Hackman. We thought we could send the script to any older actor and just force him into retirement. But then someone we knew said, you know, Billy Gerber speaks to Clint Eastwood all the time. And now Billy had been a president of Warner Brothers, and I had not seen Billy in 10 years, but he had a producing deal at Warner Brothers at this time. And I said, are you really sure that Billy speaks to Clint? And she said, I'm sure, because I was his assistant and I placed the calls. Okie dokie. So I called up Billy and I said, we have this script that we think is great for Clint, and if you agree and you get it to him in that longest of long shots, if he wants to do it, we'll make the movie together. And that's what happened.
Okay, now we're going to move to the lightning round. And the only rule for you in the lightning round is they have to be short answers, because we want these people to be able to ask you their own questions. But we're going to give a few. So just gut reactions, a moment in time in relationship to any of these things. Why don't we start out with a couple of your buddies who aren't in the room. Frank Miller.
Oh, gifted artist and storyteller. And he was doing Daredevil at Marvel. We had such Frank Miller envy. And I had lunch with him and said, what would you like to do? Just tell me whatever it is you'd like to do in comics, and I'll try to make it happen. And that turned out to be Ronin, and then Dark Knight, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Andy Warhol and electric chairs.
Well, I was a friend of Andy Warhol's, and every time he would come to see me, he would bring me a present, but he always brought me a silk screen of his electric chair.
From time to time, this would decorate your office, and it was not the warmest and most welcoming piece of art that you selected for it.
Oh, please, have a seat.
Yeah. And they thought I was the hatchet man on the team. Tim Burton.
Another amazingly talented person, and someone who really understood Batman. When he came on as the director of the first Batman, he would have meetings with licensees and with studio heads, and he would hold up the Killing Joke and say, this is what I want the movie to be like. And really, you know, in so many ways, he understood the potential of Batman, and the Batman that we had struggled for so long to put on the map, to reclaim from his early years after the TV show and things. And he had such respect for that, and I think gave us a beautiful franchise.
Milton and the Bullet and your, if I may call it that, stationary fetish.
Paul is referring to Milton Glaser, who is considered one of the giants in graphic design, actually just in design in general, certainly for the second half of the 20th century. And he did not the current DC logo, but the DC Bullet, more corporate sealed kind of logo that we had for many, many years, and our DC stationery. And I remember because when Milton came in, I'd asked him if he would do our stationery. And someone had a picture of different characters standing on each other's shoulders that had actually, I think, been drawn by Neil Adams and Dick Giordano. And I said to
Dick, I think.
And I said to Milton, well, you don't have to use this, but this piece of art is here. And he said, I've got it. I said, what do you mean you've got it? He said, I've got the design for the stationery. I said, well, what is it? He said, I can't tell you because I came up with it so fast you think I'm not worth my fee. But ultimately, it was the characters standing on each other's shoulders, printed on the back of the stationery, and the DC logo was in the front, so that it looked like a watermark seen through the stationery holding up the DC logo.
One sentence or two sentences, being a girl in a boy's world.
It was a challenge. It was a challenge, and I, the best thing was I could go to the ladies' room and be alone.
Superman Muhammad Ali. We're just reprinting that, by the way.
I know. Superman Muhammad Ali actually was a tremendously fun project and probably a huge folly in just one respect. His poster, I always had like, sort of these mad ideas. And in fact, I would knock on Paul's door just to actually peer on loom in his door. So I have this idea. And Paul said, you know, you've had too many this week. I could put this one in a folder. You can get to it later. He had this whole folder of ideas I had to get to later. And this idea was that, you know, who comes to fights? Who comes to big boxing matches? Well, you're the celebrities of the world. I said, let's populate this whole match on the covers. And it was an oversized comic with all these celebrities. And we did. And Neil Adams drew all these celebrities on the cover, but we didn't have permission. And then we had to go celebrity to, by celebrity to ask, beg for permission. And we didn't always get it. And suddenly someone like George C. Scott would become Kurt Vonnegut.
Okay, that probably hurts. Neil Gaiman.
So everybody mentioned one enormously talented person after another who has made DC what it is. I mean, can't say enough. All of you, I'm sure, agree about the Sandman comics and even things Neil, of course, has done outside of DC. He's just got the best imagination. He's a lovely, lovely person to boot. And we just have felt privileged to work with him.
Carol Fine.
Carol Fine, my beloved assistant. I always felt I was her Clark Kent. She was Superman, I was Clark Kent. And she sadly died many years ago. But she was some would say a piece of work, but she was full of life and joy and energy, and I was lucky to work with her.
For any of you who need a picture, just imagine Fran Drescher with some real energy. One of a kind. Well, if we're going to get any questions from the audience, we probably have to let them have a turn at you, even though I have quite a few more on this list. Do we have a rotating mic or a center mic or something we can work with here?
There's a mic here.
There's a mic there. As I said, you know, she's kind of soft-voiced and I'm blind as a bat. It works really wonderfully. Oh, Mr. Galloway, you're a mean man.
Well, you know, as I said, you know, Paul was the first person to say no to me, and the person who consistently said no to me. And but he always had reasons for saying no, even if I didn't agree. And he made me, throughout the years, better than I was. It was wonderful. I always think of Paul not as like I was the president and he was the executive vice president. I really think of Paul as my partner in running DC.
And in the same fashion, and in many ways, I end up being a figment of Jeanette's imagination in all of this, because if she hadn't seen through the ridiculous...
The hush puppies
and Jewish Afro and all the rest of the mess and said, yeah, I don't care if you're 19. You've got, you know, come on in and help. I certainly would not have stayed around, and I could not have possibly succeeded in any of this. So, and now, oh Lord of the trivia contests there, you ask for two questions, take them before the rest of the audience lynches you. What's your second?
Could you work both in comics and film? What are your thoughts on digital distribution and the future thereof in the internet and various other means?
Distribution of comics?
Uh-huh. Comics, film, media in general, through the internet, piracy issues, just very open.
You know, I'm sort of slow on the technological front. So I feel it's happening all around me, and I don't really have a deep understanding of it, but I do understand it's not even that it's the future, it seems to be the present.
Okay. Next, why don't you guys queue up just so we don't lose too much time bouncing around the room?
What's your next big movie project?
Well, we have a film that's going to shoot in Spain this fall that's actually a Spanish language film. And we just optioned a script that's a wonderful, wonderful script by a young writer, and the lead character is an 80-year-old man. And I couldn't help but notice that Clint Eastwood turned 80 this May.
Next.
I just want to say thank you for being here, because I did most of my reading in the 80s, but I had one time in a lot of D.C., and it's always a pleasure to see your name.
Oh, how nice.
Thank you.
I'm a craze obsessed, totally masochistic Knicks fan.
Yeah.
I'm
wondering
if you could talk a little about the experience of being there in DC when Superman, the movie, was, you know, in production and being marketed. It's really the first really big budget Hollywood superhero movie.
You know, I did not have much to do with the first one, which already had been shot when I got to D.C. and came out, I guess, Christmas 78?
Yeah. I don't know if it was all shot, but a chunk of it was, certainly.
A chunk of it. That's true. We went to see some of the shooting. But actually, I should take it back, because I had to approve Chris Reeve. So I've forgotten. Who came into the office off of a soap opera with relatively blonde hair. We had approval rights on casting. But in terms of the actual script itself, that was something that was already set. But then those first two movies were wonderful. And then when you ask about shooting, working on those movies, the second two were really terrible. And we tried to weigh in. We stood on our heads and held our breath and turned blue. But it didn't really make any difference. We were in that hierarchy of movies and comics. We were at the bottom of the totem pole.
Congratulations on your success. What I really want to know is, what was your opinion of Alan Moore and the Watchmen franchise in the 1980s, and what is it now, the movie and all?
When those books came out, they were so dazzling. They just absolutely took our breath away. And there was so much excitement in the office when the pages came in. We really couldn't believe our eyes, and we passed the pages around, and oh my God! You know, we'd be so swept away by Dr. Manhattan on Mars, and think it doesn't get more poetic or existential than that. And then all of a sudden, you had Rorschach, and it was mind-boggling. And we couldn't believe that comics had achieved that kind of a height. It was really exhilarating. As for the movie, it was tremendously faithful to the comics, and you know, whole panels in the comic or in the movie, but it didn't have for me the resonance in any way that the comics themselves do.
What is your opinion on Mr. Alan Moore?
A genius, a madman. Help change the face of comics, and I have tremendous respect for him.
Thank you.
Welcome. Hello, Flash.
For so many decades, the comics industry in general was this very New York-centered industry where so many of the creators and the editors came from Jewish backgrounds. And we were talking earlier about how you saw this increase in diversity in the comics and in the creator body while you were there. And I was wondering if you felt that there were substantive differences in the concepts in the comics or the way the narratives run as that Jewish influence has diminished in the comics industry.
I don't know if that's the reason, and it was also, I think, when I came to D.C., predominantly Jewish and Italian, I think, were probably the main two ethnic bodies contributing to comics. But sometimes when something was explicitly based in one culture, but many different, more minority cultures like Milestone, certainly those stories were dealt with more issues according to people's, own passions, concerns. But I just felt, and I'm not alone in saying this, so many of us felt that DC, not just in terms of the creators or the characters in the comics, but in terms of all of us at DC, should really be a diverse society. And the more diverse we were, the more voices we had, the better everything would be. You know, whether it was just, daily office grunt work or it was the comics themselves. And I think, looking at the comics, it really feels that way. And probably the cultural atmosphere of DC also. It's just, it's what we hoped the world would be. And in some ways, DC was a small microcosm of that, not ideal, but we strive hard to get there.
Next.
Hi there. I'd like to first thank both of you guys for everything you've done for comics for the past 35 years. Not only shaping DC, but really the comics industry in general. Jeanette, as a publisher, you did an incredible job. Paul, I started reading comics with your Legion and Wolfman Perez Titans.
He's writing it again.
I know. I'm really excited. comics have been a part of my life for a very long time. I've devoted myself to comics. I'm a retailer now. So I would really be curious to know if you have any funny stories about the birth of the direct market back in the mid-'80s. Phil Suling walking into your office saying, hey, I got this
crazy idea. I don't know if we have funny stories, but when Paul says, what was I proud of changing? And again, nothing that I did by myself. But as I mentioned very early on when we started this conversation, it was a time of opportunity, and the direct market was one of those opportunities. It was small, it was fledgling, but it had avid fans and older fans. And we kind of looked at each other and said, okay, how can we help develop this market? How can we nurture this market and still sort of not get caught in a ringer? And so I brought in someone I had met named Leon Knives, who was sort of a marketing distribution expert, and he worked hand in hand with Paul to come up with a plan that would help us grow the direct market and at the same time not get too badly burned. And that was really the beginning, I think, of our complete allegiance to the direct market. We held newsstands. For those of you who don't know, we used to put our books out in the newsstand, and then news dealers often didn't even unpack them. They just turned them back, and we would sometimes sell 20% on a newsstand, of all these comics we printed. It was so wasteful, and we weren't getting to our audience. And the direct market, of course, was a no-return business. And so we decided to bet on that. We bet that all of you who are sitting in this audience who loved comics would travel great distances to get to comic book stores, to buy comics, to have them in mint condition, to have them on the first day they were published, to have them in sequential order. And you proved us right.
And to properly credit yourself on it, Jeanette, there were many of us who shared some of those beliefs about the comic shop and where it could lead. But the direct distribution system, the early comic shops, from the point of view of the corporation, were a pretty damn scruffy lot. You want us to extend credit to these guys who have no money, who don't have a cash register, fill in the don'ts as a cascade. And there really was not, again, much of an opportunity for those of us who believed in it to do any persuading on those topics. Your reach to bring in Leon, who had forgotten more that in the last day about distribution than I would know in a lifetime, really created the opportunity to turn the corporation's point of view around on there was a method for encouraging the growth of the comic shops, and you really endorsed and gave the opportunity for the company to take a real leadership role in building the direct distribution system for the next 5 or 7 years as we took it up to the major part of the industry. Next question.
Thank you.
Oh, great Carlini.
It's a ringer.
I have a question I've wanted to ask for a long time. Who's your favorite editor?
We got time for one or two more, I guess, right?
Ms. Khan, I had the opportunity and the honor. honor to be part of the distributing team for the Anti-Mind comics when they first came out and with Psyhox in various countries, including Bosnia.
Oh, how great.
I wanted to say thank you for that. The hands-on experience that the troops must have in seeing the children take those and seeing that change their lives in such a really dramatic way for comics was absolutely amazing.
Thank you for saying that, because we didn't hear that often from people who were there.
It changed many children's lives. I saw children were out, and they were aware of what was going on because of those comics, and they identified with Superman and Wonder Woman right there on the cover. They identified what they were looking for and with the characters, and it brought them so much joy. Some of them had never seen a comic book but knew who those characters were, and you brought that to them and gave them the necessary warning they needed for what was out there. Limbs were lost and everything. So, you know, it was amazing, you know, first-hand experience. What I wanted to ask was, is there something you're championing currently? Is there something you're working on currently? What's your big project that you are trying to get awareness out about now?
You know, I don't have a big project. There are certain things that I'm dedicated to, several arts organizations in New York, and one of them actually works with kids, takes them off the streets and through creativity gets them to college and beyond. But on a large scale like Landmines, I don't, but I'm glad you brought it up because maybe I need one and it's time to tilt at some more windmills. Having heard what you said, I mean, that, again, it's just so gratifying for us to hear that.
Thank you so much.
Really, thank you.
That one wasn't enough, man. Come on. That one was all yours.
How you doing, Ms. Kenton? First of all, let me just say thank you for coming to Comic-Con and congratulations on your award. And also let me say that I'm a great fan of the Bronze Age Batman. The 70s and 80s where he introduced direct memorable characters. Killer Croc, Black Mask, among others. You mentioned earlier before about the Superman movie about casting. Before Michael Keaton was cast as Batman, did you guys have any special candidates for the role of Batman?
I don't remember who our candidates were, but when I first got a call from Mark Canton, who was the studio exec of the movie, and he said, Michael Keaton, I said, Michael Keaton? Wait. He said, don't worry. We're going to have him beef up a bit, and we're going to give him great hair, and we're going to dress him really well, and you'll see. And the truth of the matter is, I think Michael Keaton has been our best Batman because he really he showed you the neurosis that made you believe someone could put on the suit.
And he also had the best eyes, I'll tell you that. There was something in his eyes. You know, when he had that cowl on, he just goes out, he can do more than just, beat someone up. But of course, I grew up with Michael Keaton. His films were, epic. But I always kind of envisioned, Timothy Dalton as Batman. He almost looks like the character. No offense to my people.
Well, this was a time, I think, when really the acting chops trumps the looks. I don't think Michael Keaton is anybody's logical visual choice for Batman, but he really understood the character and made the movie so effective.
Well, I think we have stayed our full welcome. Unfortunately, the previous panel had overstayed theirs by a moment or two, so we're going to have to give up at this point. But thank you all very much for being here.